Hello, and welcome to episode 7 of Speak Beastie for March 13th, 2016. I'm Shannon Mickelson.
I'm Ariel Taransky.
I'm Aaron Schwartz. And today our guest host is Michael Harley. Tell everybody about yourself, Michael, where you're from, house, and MuggleNet job and stuff.
Okay. Well, thank you, first of all, you guys, for having me on Speak Beastie. I've been waiting a very long, well, all six episodes I've been waiting to be on.
So long.
Thank you very much for inviting me on. Yes, my name is Michael Harley, and I am on I've been on a few MuggleNet podcasts now. I started out actually on MuggleNet Audio Fictions, which is now discontinued, but the archive is still online. And I am now one of the hosts on Alohomora, the global reread of Harry Potter, and we're actually in Deathly Hallows. We're getting pretty close to wrapping up, actually. I am a Hufflepuff, a very proud Hufflepuff. I'm originally from Albuquerque, New Mexico, but today marks my 1 month anniversary of having moved to Austin, Texas.
Yay.
Doesn't today mark something else? Yeah.
My birthday.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Happy birthday.
I get to hang out with you on your birthday. This is so exciting.
Yes, this is fun. I haven't really gotten much of a Harry Potter feel since I moved here, so this will be nice. All I did today was my roommate took me to see Zootopia.
I want to see that. Very Harry Potter.
Is it good? Is it super good?
I will just say, Beauty and the Beast is my favorite all time Disney film. And Zootopia has now risen to my second favorite Disney film.
It was good.
Amazing. Nice. It was like one of the most thoughtful, clever films. And actually, I was trying to, this afternoon, I was like, how can I tie it back to like Harry Potter? I want to mention it as much as I can in the venues I'm on, but I'm only on Harry Potter shows. But it has a lot of the same kind of social justice issues.
We talk about everything on this show.
I mean, it's got some fantastic beasts in it,
It has some pretty fantastic beasts. I'm already planning my cosplay.
Oh my gosh. That was what I was thinking the whole movie. I was like, which character am I going to cosplay?
I'm sure, Shannon, you're probably already way ahead on your Newt Scamander cosplay.
Well, I already owned a blue coat, so...
Oh, it's perfect. Oh my gosh, it was like I made it for you.
Got the big thing out of the way. I was looking at vests, but...
Well, I can attest, I've seen Shannon's cosplays in person, and they are quite impressive, so...
I try.
I have not. I was down there in Florida, and I never once saw Shannon dressed up as anything. I just saw you. I saw you on your birthday.
Oh my gosh.
I'm just like the birthday fairy. I don't know. You're the birthday. I will grant you one wish, and that wish must require that you want to see me, and wish granted. The end. Yep.
Tell us about Patreon, Aaron.
Oh, okay. I'll do that.
That's why I was like, I'm not going to say anything more. I'm just going to let it fade.
All right. Okay. Before we get started, just a reminder that Speak Beastie is now on patreon.com. For as little as $1 per month, you can become a sponsor of Speak Beastie and help us to bring you more from Newt's fantastic world. Go visit patreon.com/speakbeastie to learn more and become a sponsor today. Some of the rewards for sponsors include access to our exclusive Facebook group to discuss theories with us and to make new friends, as well as opportunities to decide what we discuss on the Newt Case. So check that out at patreon.com/speakbeastie.
And now for the Phoenix Register. We actually got some really exciting news this past week. At the time of recording, only two stories from the Pottermore History of Magic in North America has been released. So next episode, I'm absolutely positive we will be discussing the other two stories. But for this week, we will be talking about the first piece of writing, which covers the 14th through 17th centuries, and the second piece, which covers 17th century and beyond. So let's dive right into this. The first piece actually had a lot to do with Native Americans and their magical communities. What's interesting about this story is it said wizards had known about America long before Muggles. The Native American magical community and those of Europe and Africa had known about each other long before the immigration of European nomads in the 17th century. And they explained that with travel, such as using brooms or apparating. So I think it's kind of funny to think eventually a Muggle or nomad would think he discovered America, Christopher Columbus, you know, not the director of first Harry Potter. that would have been cool. Anyway. so J.K. Rowling tied in that it was actually wizards who first discovered America, but they never actually went over and settled it or anything. So I thought that was an interesting piece of news.
Well, I was wondering because she said that wizards discovered by brooms and apparating. So I'm like, so did someone one day just go, I'm gonna go see what's this far away across the ocean?
Yeah, don't you
apparate and luckily land on a land body? Like,
yeah, don't you have to visualize what you're going to see anyway to apparate? Yeah. So,
I thought that you couldn't even apparate that far. Like you had to use a port key for something that far. You know, that's like traveling country to country. I don't think you'd be able to apparate that distance.
Continuity. I don't know.
I think it'd just be dangerous. Canon.
The piece then continues to say, in the Native American community, some witches and wizards were accepted and even lauded within their tribes, gaining reputations for healing as medicine men or outstanding hunters. However, others were stigmatized for their beliefs, often on the basis that they were possessed by malevolent spirits.
I know we're gonna get to this in our main discussion about the canon thing, but I feel like this first excerpt that she gives us is so, it's such a big summary that covers so much stuff that it feels really, not quite bland, but just, it's really imprecise.
Yeah.
So saying like, oh, some witches and wizards were accepted and some were not. It's like, that's a really big statement. That's not like, why even say that? That feels obvious.
Yeah, I feel like she was kind of just, it almost felt like a new story and she was covering like a general basis rather than telling us a story, like a very concrete who, what, when, where, because in the second story, there's mention of like wizarding historian given by name. And in this, there's no names. There's no specific Native American tribes, even just a general Native American community. So I feel like there's more she could have done on it, but I do agree that I think she was trying to be cautious of offending anyone, even though people still managed to find trouble within what she has still written.
Be offended.
Yeah, well, yeah, but I have parts of Native American in me, but I'm in no place whatsoever to sit here and be like, well, I'm not offended, so they can't be, because I'm like, that's not what I grew up as. Like, I'm mostly Polish and Irish and completely American, so I feel like I don't have the jurisdiction to make that call. And so if someone is going to be offended about it, then
There's still multiple kind of arguments about this. This was my first thought, which that if Native Americans, first of all, should be offended about anything about this, it's that this section of her story so far is really boring. Like, that was what upset me, was that this, like you said, Ariel, this just wasn't more involved. But on top of that, I think that one of the big arguments that's coming out right now against this is that it's she took Native American beliefs. This is Native American, these stories and you know, the things that perhaps people who aren't part of the Native American culture consider to be stories and mythology. These are beliefs to the Native American people. These are kind of long held traditions to the mm-hmm. American people, and they were very clear that this, to them, this isn't, these things that Rowling used, such as the idea of the skinwalkers and malevolent spirits and things like that, that's not magic in,
yeah,
to maybe people who aren't part of the Native American community, that's magic, and she could see the equivalence of it in her world. But to the Native Americans, that's not magic. It's actually their history, their beliefs. And so that it's kind of, she was walking a fine line on that. And what I think, the only thing that I think could have helped with this is if she had actually consulted Native American individuals. But yeah. Even if she had, all the Native American tribes have different
yeah.
beliefs yeah. and traditions. Yeah. And she couldn't have possibly included all of them. So it wouldn't have... I don't know if it would have worked out in the end anyway, because I think there would have also been demands from the Native American community to use their certain material and in a certain way. And I think Rowling also was kind of running the risk that she wouldn't be able to use that material in a way that fit with her mythology. I think it's better in the end that she tried it rather than not, because if she hadn't included Native Americans at all, I think that would have caused an even larger uproar at the idea that, well, why can't this community be a part of this
yeah.
story?
Yeah.
Like,
why? Yeah, I agree.
The absence of representation would
yes.
have been. It's kind of a, you know, darned if I do, darned if I don't situation.
Yep.
I agree with you. I think that it could have been something, it could have been, you know, speaking with different people of different tribes, or even just consulting someone who had more knowledge on the matter. And, you know, it's so hard because she's taking something, like she took England and, well, the UK in general, and made it very magical when there wasn't a lot. It's not like she took, say, World War II and placed magic in it. So, like, something that had happened, a part of history, she created a history. So I think that's people's problems with her inserting the Native Americans and using their actual history and stories and beliefs and making them all magical and being kind of vague about it at the same time.
Yeah, I agree. The other thing is that in British wizarding culture and European wizarding culture, there's like a distinct absence of religion, with
yeah.
the exception of
yeah.
seeing Christmas. And in Native American culture, like, religion is very important. There are a lot of religious ceremonies and customs and things that dictate how you live your life and how you interact with other people. And for J.K. Rowling to go in and say, okay, well, this thing is also because of magic or involves magic or interacts with magic, it's really tricky, because that's a real religious belief which people hold very close. So yeah, I agree with Michael, the idea that it's just, you know, you have to do it at a certain point, because if you didn't do it, it'd be way worse. But yeah, it's a really hard line to walk on.
So the excerpt continued to talk about skinwalkers, and it says a legend grew up around the Native American Animagi that they had sacrificed close family members to gain their powers of transformation. In fact, the majority of Animagi assumed animal forms to escape persecution or to hunt for the tribe.
And she tweeted to someone to specify that in her world, there are no skinwalkers, it's just a legend. Like skinwalkers as the Native Americans think of them. That it's just a legend surrounding Animagi.
Oh, okay. So that's interesting. That's
because I know that offended people.
Yeah.
Which makes, like, we'll get to the skinwalkers, because that's our in our newt mm-hmm. case for this week. But it's actually a very serious belief, especially among like the Navajo. It's a very serious belief, and it's one that, like, you don't talk about it. Everyone knows about it, but no one talks about it, and it's just very, it's very, very serious. So for her to appropriate that as like like when I was reading about it, I was like, oh, that's kind of like really, really offensive.
Yeah.
This is the big whoopsies.
Yeah.
See, I was kind of thinking this in terms of the thing it reminds me of, and in a way I don't think there was as much hubbub around this, but back in the 90s when Disney came out with Pocahontas. Mm-hmm. And
yeah.
Pocahontas.
The thing is, I really enjoyed Pocahontas as a film, and what happened for me as a kid was I became curious about what parts of the movie were real and what weren't. And the movie actually encouraged me to do some research on the life of Pocahontas, as well as other Native American individuals. I actually read a great book in middle school about Sacagawea that was one of my favorite books I've ever read. And what I'm hopeful of, perhaps, too, with this, the good that might come out of this is that there are really interesting aspects used in Rowling's version of history and her magical history that I would hope, and like what you guys do here on Speak Beastie, is that it will encourage people to pursue more knowledge about where this stuff actually comes from.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Rather than, like, because I would hate to think, and I think this was something a few critics were getting up in arms about, and I think this was a bit extreme, where they were saying, like, what if the children start believing that the Skinwalkers are animagi? And I was like, no, that I really hope that doesn't happen. And if anybody's children ever believe that, you stop them in their tracks.
Yeah.
And you, like, you fix that. Like, you know, Harry Potter, as much as we love it, and we, you know, love to kind of melded into real life and reality. I think this has kind of brought that into question, where it's that point where, like, you stop and you say, no, there's actually people's, you know, beliefs being taken into account here that we need to take into account.
So she continued on saying that they were particularly gifted in animal and plant magic, with their potions much more sophisticated than those of the ones in Europe. They had a very big difference between the magic they practiced by Native Americans, of course, and the European wizards, in that they didn't use wands. It says the magic wand actually originated in Europe. As the Native American animagi and potion makers demonstrated, wandless magic can attain great complexity, but charms and transfiguration are very difficult without one. So what do we think about this now?
She also tweeted about wands. I screen capped some tweets. Because she said that you'll find out soon where the best wands could be purchased in the 1920s when Fantastic Beasts is set.
Hmm.
So I assume we'll find that out in the next 2 days. And by the time people are listening to this, they'll know. But and she said you'll also find out when the first wand entered America, which is interesting that there's a specific first wand.
Yes.
Because I don't think that was really covered in the next piece.
Right.
I know what you're talking about. And there's a bit about wand making, but it's very small and minor. Yeah. And that's why I agree we're going to be sitting there on Sunday thinking, oh, like, if only we had this information a few days ago.
So, why didn't they do this last week?
Yeah, exactly.
The part about the wandless magic was, I thought, this was very similar to the writing on Ouagadou, the African wizarding school, because in that one she suggested, and this did not go over my head, and I'm sure it didn't go over a lot of readers' heads, that the idea that magic originated in Africa, and I was like, oh, gee golly, Rowling, I know what you're trying to say there. She was, you know, to me, making the statement that's where the beginning of life was, and humanity, and that we should maybe have a little more respect for Africa and reverence for it. She did it. I think what worked so well with Ouagadou that she was kind of trying to do here with Native Americans was kind of giving them some credit that they don't often get in fiction, and a presence in fiction that they don't often have.
Yeah.
She was very complimentary to both of those cultures in that way. But with this one, she still made more oopsies than she did with Africa.
Yeah. it's a fine line. It's very difficult to to make that distinction that, oh no, I'm trying to incorporate this into my world as a sign of reverence, not as a sign of, I don't know, anything negative. So I think that's what makes it difficult. And that's why, at least with this first story, you know, it's a part of fiction. And a lot of it needs to be taken with a grain of salt because, like Michael was saying, hopefully this just encourages people to read more on actual Native American culture and belief systems and what even different tribes believed from different tribes so as not to cluster them all into one group and say, you know, Native Americans as a whole believed this, because that's not true for any one group of people that, you know, they all believe in this one thing. So I think the first story was a short, vague introduction into her little series to get us into Fantastic Beasts and where to find them. And I'm hoping that this is just the beginning and that the Native Americans won't be dismissed entirely in the film series or in her expansions of the books, because I know last episode we were talking about there's going to be more in the Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, like the newer edition. So hopefully something more can be done with this. More and better, I should say. Not that this is...
Yeah, I'm definitely interested. I'm definitely interested to see how it'll all come into play in the films.
Yes. So the second piece of information covers the 17th century and beyond. It talks about how nomad Europeans began to immigrate to the New World. More witches and wizards of European origin also came to settle in America. They sought to blend in among the increasing tide of nomadges, or hide among the Native American wizarding population, who were generally welcoming and protective of their European brethren. And I really liked that part. For the most part, that the Native American wizarding population was happy to see the European wizarding population coming over to their side, because as we all know, there's some history of the nomad population making their way over to America, which is discussed later in the story.
She had established in the previous story that in a way there was already communication between the Native Americans and the European wizards, because they found ways, since that they had found each other already before they even came over to the New World. That goes along with, generally, I think what that was kind of the tragic part of history was, as far as reality goes, is that the Native Americans generally did want to be very welcoming of the Europeans, and then the Europeans totally took advantage of them and screwed them over right away. And spread disease amongst them, which was probably, in the wizarding version of things, was not an issue, because as we know, wizards had ways to combat a lot of common illnesses, and some kind of probably the illnesses that the Europeans would have brought over were not an issue with in the wizarding world, so that's probably true. Helped too.
Yeah, I wonder if she'll discuss that in one of the other two stories. I don't know.
I think she's over like this part now.
You know, it's interesting, these two stories like cover very specific periods of history, but the second one just says beyond, so the next two can't be like, the 18th century to the 19th century. So they have to be more specific topic.
That's true.
Well, because the next one that's coming up is about Rappaport's Law, which has something to do with Makuza and the founding of Makuza. And then the last one is kind of specific to your show. That one's 1920s Wizarding America. And that's detailing the Wandmakers, I think, is the strong point of that one. So,
yes.
Yeah. There's no... I think this will finish, like, the lengthy history piece.
Well, this does talk about how when they first came to America, they only had the few amenities, that which they had made themselves. Because back home, they only had to visit the local apothecary, yet in America, they had to forage among unfamiliar magical plants. And there were no established wand makers, and Ilvermorny at that time was nothing more than a rough shack containing two teachers and two students. So that is, I think that's a really
like the ideal school.
Yeah. That one-on-one teaching of magic. But I just think I love the idea.
Curious to know who those two teachers and two students are.
Yeah, because it's almost like it's interesting that she chose the number four again for kind of the establishment of a wizarding institute, if you will. Because, of course, there were the four founders of Hogwarts, and they have a backstory. And they were like, we're going to get together and make this school. And for Ilvermorny, it was kind of like, you're magical? Let's go to this shack. I'll teach you some things I know. Like, it's just kind of, that history seems very...
That's not sus at all.
It just seems, I don't want to say, like, less established.
You
want to
learn magic? I've got a shack down the road. Come on down.
Oh, come on.
Oh, no.
No, everything was...
Sorry, that was just so obviously creepy.
Never having Michael on again. He lags, says weird things, does these weird voices.
Good no, Lord.
I brought the lag with me.
So J.K. Rowling was explaining the troubles that these European wizards were having when they were coming over to America. The first one we just listed. The second was the conflict that developed between the immigrants, aka the Puritans, and the Native American population, because their religious beliefs made them deeply intolerant of any trace of magic. So that's when things were really starting to kind of get the ball rolling on the Salem Witch Trials, which is covered later in this story. The last problem that was encountered by wizards is actually, this is something I'm pretty sure that she created herself. This isn't any part of the stories from that time, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah, that
sounds right. Actually, I think Scours, they are some sort of historical thing, because they're in a Sherlock Holmes story.
Oh.
The Valley of Fear. I don't remember, like, super well.
But
there.
But was it American?
What they did. They were bad people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Huh. It was, in this story, a guy had, like, come over from America. So it was in the whole flashback sequence that he was in. And they were, like, bad murderer thieves people.
Oh. Well, that is how she kind of describes them. She said they were an unscrupulous.
Yeah.
Is that how you? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just words, you know, being an English major is so hard. Okay. So she did say they were an unscrupulous band of wizarding mercenaries of many foreign nationalities who formed a much feared and brutal task force committed to hunting down not only known criminals, but just basically anyone they thought would be worth some gold. They started off just trying to be some sense of authority until their corruption got the best of them and their cruelty unjustified by their mission, whatever that means.
Well, you know, I was going to say, whether or not the Scourers are actually, you know, based on a specific, like Shannon was saying, possibly a specific group of people, that I think the Scourers, I would say, and I don't know terribly too much about this point in history when there was actually this, the colonization of America, other than more the interaction with the Native Americans, perhaps, but, and I'm not remembering my history very well, but I know that this is kind of the, I'd say, like the piece of the coming to the New World that is often used in fiction, and was, I think, a big part of the New World issue, was that it was a lawless country. And and I think that, like, you see that, bringing it back to Pocahontas again, since I brought her up already, you see that in almost every film adaptation of Pocahontas, where, like, the Europeans get there and they all start killing each other. Like, before they even kill the Native Americans, they all start killing each other and screwing each other up because they don't know what to do as far as the law goes. There was another live action adaptation that came out a few years ago with Christian Bale, and I think was Colin Farrell in it, possibly too. It was not very good either, but they had, and David Thewlis was in it, and he played Radcliffe, and he got shot almost immediately when they got to the New World because he was trying to set down rules, and so they killed him, and which is not what happened to Radcliffe in real life.
That's so
right. Yes. But yeah, no, it was that's, I think that's kind of like the part that a lot of people focus on with the New World, is that there was this lawlessness that allowed people to kind of run rampant, and that was where the corruption began. So Rowling is taking that and making that's kind of where the Scourers are birthed from, is that lawlessness.
So I was just searching up Scourers because I was like, I'm not crazy. This is where Sherlock comes.
I believe you. It's
spelled different in the Valley of Fear. It's spelled Scowers.
Ah.
And so I'm looking it up, and it seems like there's not necessarily like specific organizations historically, the way that it's kind of portrayed in Valley of Fear and the way it sounds like in the Pottermore stories, but the word in the 17th and 18th centuries meant a prankster who roamed the streets at night. So it was like a commonly used word.
Okay.
But not necessarily to pinpoint a specific group of people, but that's just the way. I wonder if this is in any way a reference to Sherlock Holmes. It seems pretty similar, so.
And
that's the only other really literary thing I can find.
Yeah, you know, she likely has some experience on the matter and
yeah,
saw the word, so.
You know what, weirdly enough, it kind of sounds a little bit like Clockwork Orange. Like, does that kind of make sense? How it's, they're just,
yeah,
like, they're, it's a lawless area, and the only law are these, like, jerks who just roam around and, mm-hmm. like, harass people and
drink milk.
And drink milk.
Sorry. So this does bring us into the Salem witch trials of 1692 to 1693.
This is the good stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
We rub our hands together menacingly.
Dead people. So many dead people. Dead innocent people.
Ooh. Oh, gosh.
Like, we didn't have enough of that.
Nope, and now, yep, now we're getting into the Salem witch trials. Oh, boy.
We were way more sympathetic about that than we are about this. We're like, ooh, this is the good stuff. Like, this is, like, this, all of this really still happened. Like, it doesn't stop the fact
that it was horrific.
Yeah, like, people died, and, oh, good lord. We're coming across as such good people.
Well, I think in a weird way, though, that, like, she treats this with pretty much the same level of sincere sensitivity, actually.
Yeah. She does kind of segue with the Scourers, saying there are at least two known ones who were part of the Salem witch trials and getting them started. Mm-hmm. So a lot of actual witches did end up being arrested and killed for the crimes, even though they were innocent for them. And then there were no mages who just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, and people were caught up in that whole mob mentality, trying to, you know, accuse everyone of being a witch. This had an effect on the Europeans then deciding, okay, do we come to America or not? Because a lot of witches and wizards ended up fleeing America, and some just decided not to go there at all. And this had an interesting effect, surprisingly, on the lineage of magic, like the bloodlines, I should have said. A far higher percentage of nomad-born witches and wizards in the New World was a result of the Salem witch trials, like, than anywhere else. So, because so many actual witches and wizards decided to leave America or never come, they kind of relied on the nomad born, which is a weird, I'm trying to make my mouth get used to it. That's primarily where witches and wizards were coming from. And these witches and wizards often went on to marry, found their own all magical families, but the whole pure blood ideology that was very prominent in Europe and obviously in the Harry Potter series actually gained far less traction in America. So what does
that
explains
why
that?
There's no Voldemort in America. That was wonderfully convenient. I actually like that, because that was like, that's like the first positive thing she's given North America.
And I like, it ensures that we don't have to like worry about that in the films. along with this whole, like, second Salemers and stuff. We don't have to worry about the wizards also fighting amongst each other, being like, ah, but purebloods and
yeah.
stuff
like I did take a little bit of issue with kind of, she kind of scraped over some of the details of the Salem Witch Trials, because I have kind of stored a lot of the wizard cards that came out in with the mm-hmm. with the video games, because those are canon. She wrote those, those were some of my favorite things that ever came out of Harry Potter, because those were kind of the first canon things that were coming out of something that wasn't the books. And one of them was, and she's mentioned in Prisoner of Azkaban very briefly, Wendolyn the Weird. And
yes.
she oh, was yeah. burned at the stake in the Middle Ages multiple times, because all she used was a freeze flame charm. And so the flames just tickled her, and she loved being burned at the stake. So,
for that.
And of course, you know, that's not the only way that quote-unquote witches were disposed of in Salem, but that was certainly one of the most popular mm-hmm. ways to dispense of a witch. And I feel like wizards had come up with a lot of ways to combat the persecution of something like the witch trials, because they'd already gone through that in the medieval ages. So I found it weird that she said that a lot of wizards were victim to the witch trials, because I was like, didn't they have defenses for this? Like, if anything, I would have just thought more innocents would have been killed than actual, because, of course, as we know, there as much speculation as there might be about the Salem witches, most historians agree that, no, they were not witches. They were just poor, innocent women
yeah.
who were accused, because it was the whole, basically, it was the whole idea that women were stepping out of the very, like, small role that had been set for them in Puritan society. Like, you stay at home and you sweep with the broom. You don't ride the broom, you sweep with it. And if you ride the broom, then you're a witch. So it was that idea that women were actually kind of starting to try and leave the confines of their world, so therefore mm-hmm. burn the witch. So I thought that was interesting that she ended up saying that there were a lot of victims to this, because they had defenses against that already.
Well, she does say that the creation of Macusa started in 1693 as a result of the Salem witch trials, because...
Right after the...
Yeah. It says it was the first time that the North American wizarding community came together to create laws for themselves. So yeah, it does kind of bring to question what Michael was saying, what... the information we were given previously and the information that we've just been given in this story, it kind of, the question of canon and even continuity has to be addressed, because it is potentially confusing. Even I'm sitting here and I remembered how they would talk about other witches would take precautions so that they didn't, you know, get killed while being burned at the stake, yet we were just told that some of them actually did.
Harry was literally writing an essay in Prisoner based on the prompt, "Witch burning in the 14th century was completely pointless. Discuss." That is what the prompt was. So.
I want to write that essay. Right. I want my schoolwork to be that exciting. So,
but again, I know there.
I'm sure Harry didn't.
I know there were other
exciting.
Ways to dispense of, yeah. that they dispensed of witches in, mm-hmm. in the Salem witch trials. So I don't know if wizards had. I don't know if they had any combatant against being hanged. I suppose when you're hanged, you're hanged. So, but.
Yeah.
I don't know. I was a little. I kind of wanted just a tad more on that, because I think that's. We got a taste. Like, I feel like we just got like a tiny taste in Goblet when we. Saw that there was a wizard school in America, like the Salem Witch something or other like that.
Salem's
yeah.
Witches Institute.
Yeah, and I think that kind of piqued people's interest about how Salem kind of worked into Harry Potter. So, basically, I'm...
Yeah, and if she just...
Oh, I was just going to say, basically, I'm being a whiny little child, and I want more. Sorry.
Damn it, Michael.
Well, it is like you're right though. It is kind of weird for her to kind of gloss over the Salem witch trials and not be more specific when the like Salem Witches Institute was a thing. It's like, but like if you're going to build a school there, you know, there'd be a reason why you would do that. And if this wasn't really a big deal, then I guess there's no real reason to do that. It just feels kind of like flimsy. Like, yeah, never mind.
This is our big witch thing, Rowling. This is all we got. So, come on.
This is what we contributed to history. Well, so she kind of segues into Mikusa's first task being to put the Scourers on trial because they had betrayed their own kind. And I think this is how we're going to see some of the Second Salemers and who they really are, because it says a lot of them eluded justice and married nomadges and founded families where magical children appeared to have been winnowed out in favor of non-magical offspring, and they instilled this knowledge into their children that magic was real, and if they were to find a witch or wizard, they needed to be killed wherever they were found. And
this is so weird.
Yeah.
Isn't this weird? Like, yeah. These wizards who pursued other wizards were like, I'm only going to have muggle children, but I'm going to tell them that wizards exist and that they should go kill them. Like, what? 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 I just feel like I'm
as you do.
Feel like I'm...
And here's the life lesson. Some people just suck. And that's it.
The end. That's the show.
I feel like there's like one more bit to moral that story that's just missing.
Because I don't even want to get into it, but it's, first of all, how could you become a Scourer and betray your own magical community and, you know, the people within that community? Because you have to have some sense of camaraderie, like, hey, we're in this together and we have to keep this secret hidden. Instead, you're burning these people at the stake, and then you're having children with non-magical folk and telling them magic's real. Like, it feels very Mr. Crocker from Fairly Odd Parents, where he's like got that insane,
oh my god, Mr. Crocker's a Scourer. Been there all along.
We That's solved it. It really, really though, like, it doesn't follow any sort of logic to me. And I don't mean that in a mean way. It's just what Michael was saying. Like, that's weird. I feel like something's missing. And it does say that as a result of the Scourer families and their anti-magic beliefs, that the North American nomadges often seem harder to fool and hoodwink on the subject of magic than many other populations. So I know she's trying to push this into Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, and possibly why, what's his name? The nomad.
Jacob.
God, I was going to say Ben. I don't know why.
Because that sounds like a really unmagical name. Ben.
Ben. Nomad Ben. I think that's what she's trying to lead into. And I can understand that. But at the same time, it does feel, the ending felt very hasty to me, because I'm like, oh, that's what happened. Okay.
Yeah, I don't, like, this is the first time that we're getting Pottermore information that's actually meant to tease an upcoming thing. Like, this is teasing Fantastic Beasts, all of this. And I'm kind of feeling it based on the writing. So.
Yeah, I agree.
Compared to the previous, I mean, notwithstanding that they split it into four pieces, like, Pottermore's never done that, where they're like, we're going to do a big release, but in four different pieces for no reason, because we need more website hits, so please, in 4 days.
First movies being split into two parts, now online information.
In four pieces, yeah.
What's next?
Part two was way better than part one.
Part one was blah.
Yeah, part one sucked.
Part one was, like, barely anything.
part one was, I don't want to offend Native Americans, so I'm not going to do anything with them.
I almost...
They were nice and perfect, and that was it.
So, that's all for the news.
Wow.
I know it wasn't much. Yeah. We really did not cover anything. So, what are we going to do now?
I think...
Let's head into the main discussion. So for today's main discussion, we're going to talk a little bit about the film and filmmaking. So J.K. Rowling wrote the Fantastic Beasts movie. As far as we know, she wrote the script alone, and as far as we know, she's going to write all three movies. Sorry, tangent, but did you guys see when, like, she said something about it's going to be a trilogy, and all of those news outlets were like, oh, it's going to be a trilogy, three new Harry Potter films, and I was like, where have you been?
Yeah.
The past year.
I had to sit there for a second and think.
Anyway.
No, it's okay, because
I had to bring that up.
I had to think, I was like,
no,
this not common knowledge?
They'll never understand.
Yeah.
And the big thing with what you were saying, Shannon, is... As far as we know, Rowling is the main writer.
Yeah.
This is the thing about making movies. There's almost never one screenwriter. There will probably be a lot of people who go tragically uncredited on these movies and who probably were brought in by the studio to do a few touch-ups on things here and there. So, especially because this is Rowling's first movie script. Like, as much as people trust Rowling and as much control as she has over things, I know in movie land she does not have that much, I'm sure she does not have that much control to have had the whole script to herself.
Yeah, I feel like it's very common for people to come in.
So, script writing and novel writing are very different. And that's she's not writing, she hasn't written Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. We know that, but we know that it's like her and two other people who developed the story for the play, and Jack Thorne wrote it. And so that's to think that she's the only person who has worked on the Fantastic Beasts script at all. That's probably not true.
Yeah. I feel like it's very common for someone to come in and do edits or touch-ups, as Michael was saying, because I practically live on my IMDb app. And we'll see information on certain movies like, oh, so-and-so did this uncredited edit for the script. And it just seems to be a common occurrence. There are two very different mediums. And I feel like the transition wouldn't be too easy. I feel comfortable, even though I'm a college student and haven't published anything and I'm not J.K. Rowling, I feel more comfortable writing books than I do screenplays because I've taken more classes on fiction writing. And that's what I've been doing predominantly for most of my life, and I wouldn't even know where to begin with a screenplay, so I feel, of course, she's had to have some help in that area. The question is just how much.
The other thing is that screenwriting and movies and film, by their nature, are more exclusive than writing a novel. Like, in a novel, you can have all the stuff that you want. And then in a movie, you have to filter all of, or a lot of that stuff out because it doesn't directly affect the plot. And if that's the case, then the things that are in the movie, they may be considered canon or whatever, but they're very specific and small. So I think that's one of the reasons why it was so weird with, like we were talking about earlier, with Pottermore and the things being a little bit bland and not really filling out the world, because it's like, well, we know in the movie we're going to get relatively a very thin slice of world. And if you're going to try and fill it out, then fill it out.
That brings us to canon and what the foop even is canon anymore. Because Fantastic Beasts is going to be a movie, obviously. But J.K. Rowling is writing it, and she wrote the books, and other people wrote the Harry Potter movies, so does Fantastic Beasts. Follow the canon of both, because the canons of both are definitely very different. Does it just follow the canon of the books? Does it just follow the canon of the movies? Then you've got Pottermore in here messing everything up. Like, what's happening?
I don't know.
There's too much stuff. See, I was complaining earlier that there wasn't enough, and that's too much.
That's been a big complaint recently, I think.
Yeah. No, that has. There's, I think, like, just from the new information that came out on Pottermore, there's already been articles with people saying, like, stop, J.K. Rowling, just stop. You're ruining the wizarding world. Which, you know, personally, I know people get very upset about that. To me, personally, it's like, I kind of pick and choose my own canon based on the information that comes out. Like, I have a canon that, like, yeah, most of what Rowling says to me is canon. Like, her tweets, unless there's something majorly contradictory, which she usually will fill with another tweet, then I take that as canon. I take the wizard cards that she released earlier as canon, what she had on her old website, that was stuff that she wished she could have included that she said she would have had as canon. I take Pottermore as canon, but, like, when J.K. Rowling says, there's 1,000 students at Hogwarts, I'm like, no, they're not. That's absurd. There's no math that adds to that.
I was just
So that doesn't, like, that one I don't, you know, I'm personally selective about. And with Fantastic Beasts, I mean, the trailer starts right away with Newt saying Lumos Maxima, which is not book canon. That's not a spell in the books. Maxima is not an addendum to canon spells, so you have already got kind of an issue there.
Yeah, I definitely made a comment on, like, our first episode. I was like, so Lumos Maxima, huh? The issue that a lot of people are having now is that if she keeps on adding more stuff and expanding this world, then what can we say is still canon, kind of like how the Star Wars universe, like, has its expanded universe, which is, like, outside of canon, kind of, and how Disney is like, no, that's not really a thing anymore. And so what can we consider canon now if she's changing and adding so much?
I was totally going to mention Star Wars because that's what it makes me think of. And as a child, I didn't know anything of canon and, you know, not canon because you read a story, that's it, that's what you got. And now we live in a day and age where we can actually interact with our favorite authors on social media and we can get more information. And it's, in a sense, kind of a double-edged sword because I really love standalone books. Of course, I love Harry Potter and the fact that there's, you know, 7 books. But the thing I like about standalone books is that it's done, it's over, you can leave it. And I feel like that should be the case with a lot of books, because it almost snowballs, like, you get this information and, oh, you're going to get this and this, and it expands so far. And how things are going with the Fantastic Beasts series and the things we learned on Pottermore, it begs the question, are we getting too much? Because there has to be some sense of mystery. Of course, I like the information I'm getting, like when we learned Sirius's birthday and just, you know, little tidbits like that, things that I feel like don't necessarily affect the story. You know, it's a little fact about a character we like, but it does kind of get to a point where you do really have to question, what is canon? What are all of these bits of information going to do to that canon? Do we let it do anything to that canon? It's convoluted and complicated, and even though we're sitting here doing a Fantastic Beasts podcast, it does eventually lead into, how is it going to affect Harry Potter? Because we've talked about the possibility of a young Dumbledore make an appearance, or someone, they have said that someone from Harry Potter, the Harry Potter series, excuse me, will be in Fantastic Beasts. And so it does have that crossover. And so it does have some semblance of, well, this is canon because this happened to this person when they were meeting Newt.
It's interesting because canon, the word, as we, like, use it, well, first it originated with the Bible, to be like, this is the canonical Bible. But for, like, fandom, I'm gonna bring up Sherlock Holmes again, because it was with Sherlock Holmes that we started to use canon to be like, this is Arthur Conan Doyle's works are canon, and then future pastiches are not canon because they weren't written by Arthur Conan Doyle. But Arthur Conan Doyle had the worst continuity ever within his stories. Like, within one story, the seasons would change from day to day. And, like, John Watson is only called John, I think, twice or 3 times. And that's only in, like, chapter titles of the books. It's like, the account of John Watson. And then in the text, he's referred to as James once, so, like, who even knows? Arthur Conan Doyle obviously cared a lot less than J.K. Rowling does, but it just goes to show that, like, authors get stuff wrong within their own stories all the time.
That made me think of L. Frank Baum and The Wizard of Oz, if you've ever read the original 14 Oz books, because if you talk to the Oz fans, they have that
my
same issue.
Was
because
just explaining those to me because she's reading them.
Oh my goodness, they're great, they're fantastic books, but just and Baum did the same thing that Rowling did with, actually, with the Fantastic Beasts opening, where she kind of has her little letter where she's where she kind of makes it canon that she's part of the world, and that she's like, oh, I get communications from the world, and that's why they publish the books under my name. And Baum did that with Oz, where he would get, like, he said he was getting, like, Oz set up some kind of telegraph system with him so that he could learn all the stories about Oz from the Emerald City and all that. But he had all these continuity issues as well. But what I was thinking about, too, was, and I will just touch on it briefly, this does go into the canon issue and the continuity issue, again, of is this book canon? Because they did specifically pick, as director, David Yates. David Yates has a very specific style in relation to Harry Potter. Well, he seems to. I don't think he did four movies and they all look different to me. The one thing I can see about Yates' style that's continuous is that he never puts anything in the center of the frame. You can even see that when you watch the Fantastic Beasts trailer. There is nothing centered in the frames. Everything is always to the side. I don't know if it's because he just loves widescreen and he's like, I'm going to use all of this, which would be a nightmare if we still had 4x3 TVs. I don't know how they'd crop his films. But, you know, Yates put his stamp on the Harry Potter world with his style. And he brought, from what I understand, Fantastic Beasts has brought most of the production team over from Harry Potter. So now we're also dealing with, like, I know you guys were talking earlier about wands. Wands in the movie world are all unique in their design and they're gorgeous and beautiful. Wands in the Harry Potter book world are just pretty sticks, like they're glorified sticks, which Pottermore confirmed. So they're like lightly carved sticks. So are the pretty fancy ones canon now, or are the it's issues like that. And really, they're, god, these are such first world problems, what, now that I'm hearing this all coming out of my mouth. But like you were saying too earlier, Ariel, it's the double-edged sword piece of it. Was I'm sure we all remember back in the day, you know, that I think a lot of people who wrote Harry Potter fan fiction were clamoring for details like this, right?
Me.
Me too. You can't see me. I'm raising my hand. But yeah, these were details that people wanted to make their fan fiction more canon. Like, oh, my fan fiction is as close to Rowling's writing as possible. Because, I mean, I think a lot of people who wrote fan fiction, there were some people who loved to write crazy fan fiction that had nothing to do with Harry Potter and barely related to it. but there were a lot of, I was in the camp who preferred fan fiction that was close to Rowling's style and fit her world really well. And now people are saying, well, now you gave us too much information and why should we even bother having an imagination about this? Because you have all the answers to every single thing. We can just tweet you, like, what did Harry eat for breakfast this morning? Oh, he had a bagel. And then somebody puts that down on the calendar. It's like, March 9th, 2016. Harry ate a bagel. So it's like a thing now.
Yeah.
Sorry, that was too Harry Potter and not enough Fantastic Beasts. March 9th of 1927. Hormatina ate a bagel.
Scamander.
When it comes to canon as far as Fantastic Beasts, a big issue is we're going to get visual screen depictions of what these beasts look like. Mm-hmm. And up till now, canon has mostly been what the pictures that Rowling drew in Fantastic Beasts. And it'll be interesting to see, because I know a lot of choices that were made with some of the creatures that showed up in the original. Like, the centaurs are a mess in the original films.
Oh my god.
And they didn't even start by fitting them closely to what the book said. And then they got even farther away from it in their second depiction, you know, and then I believe, and centaurs are mentioned quite a bit in Fantastic Beasts. So what other beasts will fall victim to, oh, we didn't like her description, so we changed it completely.
Yeah.
Sorry, that was my rant. I'm gonna get off my pedestal now.
I think for a little bit in Lair, my brain was like, you're just listening to an episode of Alohomora, you can like wander off. I was like, no, wait, I'm on this show. All right, well, let's move on to the time turner today. So we talked a little bit about Native American magic, quote unquote, earlier. So I looked a little bit into what was happening with the Native Americans in the 1920s when Fantastic Beasts is set. Predictably, not really great things were happening. Non-Native Americans, white people, were trying to assimilate the Native Americans into their society because basically they were like, let's completely get rid of Native Americans altogether. And the Native Americans were having none of that. Entrepreneurs were looking a lot into resources at reservations. I read one thing about like a coal mine where a white guy got this coal mine that was on a reservation and then he gave non-Native Americans free coal. But the Native Americans had to pay for the coal, his reasoning being that the Native Americans couldn't figure out how to get coal. I don't know. And then at that time, Native American religious practices were illegal, which we touched on how important religion is to, well, to a lot of people, but to Native Americans. But they were pretty much just going forward with all of their things anyway. So since, you know, we've had this stuff about Native American magic being important, I wonder how much of that will actually come up in the 1920s era that we are in the films. Because as far as I know, there are no Native American actors cast in the first film. So I should certainly hope that means there are no Native American characters, because I would hope that people of other races aren't playing them.
Yes.
But what does that mean?
Don't want another Rooney Mara.
One of the things that's interesting, like you said, the assimilation into society is how would an American wizarding society assimilate Native American wizardry into it? Like, I think it was at this time, my history dates might be a little bit off, but one of the big things was like the phrase destroy the savage, save the man, where it was all, the goal was basically to whitewash Native American culture and assimilate Native Americans into white, basically white culture. So what would that look like from wizarding culture perspective when J.K. Rowling has kind of told us with the stuff earlier in this episode about how there was more reverence for Native American practices?
And especially the acceptance of the Native Americans when the Europeans first came over of, you know, the wizarding community. It also makes me wonder, would the Native Americans choose to attend Ilvermorny, or were they allowed at that point in time with all of this going on? I almost wonder if there was more of a sense of, we need to protect our Native American wizard friends, or if the wizards and the nomads' views lined up. It's something that could be looked at in the movies, but I doubt that they will. We talked about this last episode, how we doubt race will really be under a microscope for these movies because they want to focus much more on the magic and the beasts and lighthearted things. Not to say that they shouldn't touch on race, because I think they should, and I would like to see that, but even with her summary of the Native Americans being so vague, I think they'd be so worried about offending somebody or saying something or doing something wrong that it might just not be touched on.
I think it would be nice to see if, because what Rowling has effectively done with the writing of these last two pieces is established what she kind of already is implied in Harry Potter, and which she clarified, I believe, on Twitter, which is, people have asked her, I think, if there were racial issues amongst wizards, if there were racial prejudices amongst wizards in Europe as well. And a lot of people have asked her about race and sexuality, and she's basically said, no, that's not really a problem amongst wizards in Europe. And I think with these last two pieces of writing, she's established that that's also not an issue in America, and that they, wizards in Europe, more focused on the blood purity, and that was their issue. And over in America, now it's this weird thing with the Scourers, who have a vengeance that they've put into no mages against wizards. And what I like about that, and what I see the opportunity for that I don't think is going to happen, is that that opens up the inclusivity, and in that you could possibly have people from all races and backgrounds being a part of this story and have a more diverse cast, because in this world, as in many fantasy worlds, this is not it. Race is not an issue. Sexuality is not an issue. There are larger issues at hand, as is suggested by the plot of Fantastic Beasts. So in a way, it's kind of unfortunate that from what we've seen so far casting wise that's probably not gonna happen. And with as far as the Native Americans go, it is interesting that she's kind of really built them up here in these writings, and that we haven't gotten a hint that they're gonna be very involved in the story of Fantastic Beasts. It's kind of almost a shame at this point, because there's, and who knows, we also don't have confirmation if the next two Fantastic Beasts are even going to take place in America, or if they're going to move to the UK or even another country entirely. So that's hard to say. There's potential for it, but who knows if she'll capitalize on that. It's just a shame that she's created this safe place for all racial backgrounds to be a part of, but that may not even be what we're going to get casting-wise.
Yep.
So this week in the Newt case, we have skinwalkers. J.K. Rowling mentioned this week in her new update on Pottermore the idea of the skinwalkers. So I went in and did a little bit of research on the Native American legends. Many Native American tribes, such as the Navajo, the Hopi, the Utes, they have their own version of the skinwalker. I'm going to focus mostly on the Navajo because it's a little bit more consistent and easier to find. the Navajo skinwalker is known as the Yi Naldlushi, which translates to, "With it, he goes on all fours." And whereas J.K. Rowling kind of makes it seem like it's a little bit lighter, it's actually terrifying and it's straight up evil. It's not widely spoken about among the Navajo, but it is generally well known. The general description is that skinwalkers, they can be coyotes, wolves, foxes, eagles, owls, crows. They can be all kinds of different things, but they generally wear the skins of the animals that they transform into. So it's considered taboo to wear the pelt of any animal in the tribe, save for sheepskin or buckskin, which are worn for different ceremonies and things. Most legends say that if you ever lock eyes with a skinwalker, they can absorb themselves into your body. They can body snatch you. They can control your mind, read your thoughts, or mimic your voice. And according to University of Nevada, Las Vegas anthropologist Dan Beneschik, skinwalkers are purely evil in intent. They make people sick, they commit murders, they are grave robbers and necrophiliacs. They are greedy and evil people who must kill a sibling or another relative to be initiated as a skinwalker. To make it even more terrifying, some sightings include different stories of deer or other animals that climb or run like men on their back legs, or seeing men or women sort of just change and take off running on all fours at great speeds. A lot of them are chasing cars or buses or things. So you're just driving in the middle of nowhere and you just see a figure that looks like a wolf or some big hairy monster just charging after your car. It's really terrifying. And which most legends kind of give, instead of having the animagus feel where it's like, oh, you're a wizard and you turn completely into that animal. The legends surrounding skinwalkers seem to be a little bit more werewolfy, where it's half in, half out. Like I said earlier in the podcast, they're very serious, very deeply seated into this culture. So it is a little touchy for J.K. Rowling to take that and kind of appropriate it.
I wonder how much research she did on it, because what you said was very, you know me, I'm scared about everything, but what you said about all of these things, how they make people sick and commit murders, and she definitely made it seem more, I don't want to say lighthearted than it actually is, but she downplayed it a lot. I guess yeah. is what I mean.
I think the big mistake she made with this was that she said in her version that nomad medicine men, I'm assuming nomad medicine men in Native American tribes is what she was referring to, came up with this version of skinwalkers to discredit wizards in the Native American mm-hmm. community because they were scared of them or because they were worried that they were going to lose their power because and their hold over a community because of that. Interesting idea. Probably pretty offensive, I would say, the way that she ended up doing it, because that in that way she said, no, they were actually just animagi, and it was fun, and it was like they were nice people, and maybe the issue here is that she chose the wrong thing to play it with.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is a lot like saying, like, oh, your thing, that's not true at all. Yeah. Like, it's instead of just saying, oh, well, it was a little bit more like this, or like the fact that, like you mentioned, that it was nomad medicine men who made this up makes it seem like, oh, you guys made this up and it's fake, not, oh, we're in a world where I've decided that this thing is like this. So it's a little bit
yeah
touchy.
And it's unfortunate because I can see why she would have thought the connection was so good. I kind of was hoping that Native Americans would have an almost completely a brand of magic that was almost advanced and unique to them, and that their practices and reality would have just been incorporated that way and would have been explained away as the real fact that the Native American people tend to keep their traditions to themselves and don't share a lot of these things with the outside world. And perhaps in the wizarding world, that could have been the same way, that while they were very welcoming of their fellow wizards, they still kept a lot of their deeper practices to the and their deeper magic to themselves. But that didn't go that way, so it's too late. But you should have talked to some... Maybe you should have talked to some Native Americans, Rowling.
So that's it for this episode. Be sure to send us in your news stories, fantastic theories, comments, questions, even your K-pop remixes if you have to. And we really want to thank Michael today for joining us, especially on his birthday. So happy birthday.
Thank you, Michael, for letting me join you. And I'm sure we share a lot of listeners between us with Alohomora and Speak Beastie. So if any of your Speak Beastie listeners want something to fill the gap between while they're waiting for your next episode, they can always come on over and listen to Alohomora and comment on our website too. Feel free, alohomora.mobilenet.com. Hey. But in the meantime...
You know, I suggested...
Oh, go ahead, Shannon.
I suggested that we do an Alohomora Speak Beastie rap battle, but, like, people weren't going for that.
I can't rap.
And also, there's a lot of lag, so that'd be pretty hard.
I'd do it. Hamilton.
Yeah. Shannon, you're our sole contender, so have at it.
She's not going to actually rap. So I'll wrap this up. Oh. How about... Oh, ho.
Ah.
Ah.
So in the meantime, while you're waiting for the next episode of Speak Beastie, you can also... There's plenty of ways to get in contact with the show. You can find Speak Beastie on Twitter and Instagram, at Speak Beastie. That's easy enough. Facebook.com/Speak Beastie. At Tumblr, speakbeastie.podcast.tumblr.com. Oh, and also you guys have a Patreon, which I was so excited to hear you had set up, because Alohomora just got one too, but I was so jazzed to hear that Speak Beastie got one too. So you can head to patreon.com/speakbeastie. You can donate as little as, I believe, $1 a month or something like that to support the show, to keep Speak Beastie going, which of course you want to do, because, I mean, you heard the show. It's majing. And please leave a review for the show as well on iTunes. You can find Speak Beastie just searching it on the iTunes store. Leave all your kind and thoughtful words for the show.
I'm Shannon.
I'm Ariel.
I'm Aaron.
And I'm Michael. Oh, do I get to say the case closed? Who says case closed?
Yeah, you do.
I'll say it in a 1920s way. Case closed. Thank you.
And so, well, the big
and
question
also
is
the nature
canon.
Oh god.
Lag. I'm sorry. I was
just like over on my end.
Such
the log.
Big lag.
It was just
this
was
lag
like the longest
is just
pause of
the,
life.
The worst. Yeah, I remember you talking about that, Eric, because I was that same person.
I think you're right. Damn lag.
Oh, God, that was the worst lag. Oh, my God, that hurt. So I'm just going to go. I feel like I should just hide under my bed. That lag was so bad. I'm
Michael.
Drowning. I'm falling out of my chair. So,
you're
so
you're drowning in your chair.
I'm drowning in my chair.
Oh, I'm dying. Okay, I'll shut up, and maybe y'all will hear me in 30 seconds.
And, well, and what you said,
well, it's
Ariel, about...
Because,
Okay,
it happened again.
Who wants to go first?
Shannon, you go. I stuck Fantastic Beasts. I stuck my book in my mouth when that happened. So you go.
Aaron, you go ahead.
Aaron, you were gonna say something.
Good episode, guys.